It's September, school's back, and so are we. Next on Principles and Policies. Welcome to today's edition of Principles and Policies. I'm your host, Barry Sheets, the Executive Director of the Institute for Principled Policy. And along with me today is our co-host, the Vice Chairman of the Institute, my fellow analyst and very good friend, Chuck Michaelis.
Hey, it's good to be back with you, Barry. After several weeks, you know, we it's not like we haven't tried to record. But things keep getting in the way. Business trips, equipment issues, you name it, we've probably dealt with it.
Mm-hmm. You're right. It's been all kinds of things. Now, one of the things that I haven't had to deal with, but you've had to deal with, was something that you mentioned, business trips, that happened on a recent business trip of yours. Which I think that our listeners might find very entertaining and instructive.
Well, let's hope so. otherwise, we're wasting our breath. No, I was in California. I was in Glendale, California, which is a Los Angeles suburb. A suburb is a almost a misnomer out there. There's city every place. Until you get way, way, way out in the San Fernando Valley. While we were there, wildfires broke out. And when I say wildfires broke out, I mean the largest wildfire in Los Angeles history, broke out. And we had fires, very scary looking fires, especially at night, within a couple miles of the hotel. I mean, The way it worked is something started a fire up in the foothills around Los Angeles.
And it wasn't Chuck or his family.
No, we were not involved in starting the fire. We were involved in being scared of the fire. And neighborhoods around us did get evacuated. Now, in the end, luckily, it burned a bunch of stuff that... It really didn't have much on it. Only four houses burned. Now, I say only. It's not only to the four people who were burned out of their homes.
Right.
But nonetheless, it was only four houses, and I don't think anybody was killed. I don't think anybody...
Well, praise God for that.
Yes, I don't think anybody was burned up. There were injuries because firefighters get out there. Let me tell you, you get up in those foothills, it's steep, man. We go up and visit a couple things that are up on top of the mountains that are, you know, Griffith Park and place. We drive up on Mulholland Drive, which is a scenic overlook drive. There's a couple of overlooks, and my daughter and her boyfriend went and walked around a little outside the bar, you know, a little outside the normal place to go. And, I was a little bit like, oh, wow, it is far down there, and it is steep. If you fall down, we can't get you. We have to call and have the helicopters come get you if you survive it. Because we were, you know, 800 feet up. They're 400-foot drops into the canyons down there. So when you hear about hikers being injured or killed, it's not surprising. And plus, you know, they got rattlesnakes and stuff out there. We were up on a mountaintop, and they're like out on a path, and I'm like, man, just watch for rattlesnakes. Cause it was, we also had a record breaking heat wave while we were there, which is part of the reason there was a wildfire.
Yes.
But when you watch those wildfires spread, I'll be quite honest, at night it's frightening because they crawl along the ridge top, and when they hit something big and dry and flammable at the heat that they're at, the thing just bursts into flames. And when it does that, it throws up like a big giant torch of flame and fire. And, it's real, and what's weird is it looks like it's burning down. The fire looks like it's running out of fuel and burning down, and it'll hit a spot where there's a big, you know, group of dry, flammable tinder, and it is dry out there this time of year, and it would just suddenly burst into a giant, you know, mushroom cloud of flame and smoke, and yeah, it's a little apocalyptic, especially at night. We went up to a place where we were on top of a mountain. We were at Universal City, Universal Studios. We went up there for dinner. They have a place called City Walk that has restaurants and shops and things. And we drove up there and parked and stood in the parking garage and watched the fire. And it stretched for literally miles, 6, 7, 8 miles along the top of a mountain. When you see that, and it's a big fire, it's frightening. I'll give that to you right now. It's frightening. Now, out there, they're sort of used to it. They're a little nonchalant about it. But when you wake up in the morning and you go out to your car and it's covered with ash, just everything has a thin layer of ash all over it, you know the fire's close. And we knew the fire was close when we went up to the Griffith Park Observatory. And they were a little worried about all the smoke because smoke is very damaging to... they had all the both the big telescope up and running, and they had some little telescopes out on the lawn there running, and you could look at different things. We looked at Saturn. We looked at the moon. We looked at different objects. And it's damaging to mirrors. It's bad enough, you know, those the kind of telescopes they had on the lawn are reflective. And it requires a parabolic mirror. And it's very damaging to the coating on a mirror that particular, you know, combination. You have to clean those right up. It's kind of caustic. It's bad for your lungs. You know, you sneeze, you'll be walking along and you get ash in your eye. You know, it's not hot, but it is ash, and it's irritating to your eyes. I was up there and I got ash in my eye while I was up there, and the people running the telescopes were looking back and pointing at it in very solemn tones, talking, you know, we may have to break down and that kind of stuff. So, beautiful place to visit, a little bit frightening. Another thing, we talked about that I had done while I was out there, mm-hmm. We went to the Reagan Library.
Yes.
In Simi Valley. Simi Valley is 30 miles northwest of Los Angeles. Ladies and gentlemen, let me tell you something. If you get a chance, if you are ever in the Los Angeles area, go out to Simi Valley and go up the mountain to the Reagan Library. It sits smack on a mountaintop. It's the most beautiful view you'll see. It's just stunning. And when you get inside, it's a very good reminder of, you know, I was telling my kids this. I'm like, you guys can't quite really understand how really, truly bad it was in the late 70s. Just from grotesque mismanagement, attempts to run roughshod with the liberal agenda. I can remember the president at the time, Jimmy Carter, saying things like, Americans are just going to have to learn that they're probably never going to be able to buy a house. They're probably never going to, you know, we'll have to go to multifamily dwellings. In other words, apartments. Everybody wanted to build apartments every place, condos and that kind of thing. The day of private ownership of homes is over. You're going to have to learn how to do without a car. That kind of stuff. Because if Barry, if you remember, I tried to buy a car in 1981.
I don't think we knew each other back then.
No, we did not. We've talked about it. My car was destroyed in an automobile accident in 1981, so I had to buy a new one. Well, I tried to buy one, and I did eventually get one. And guess what the interest rate was? It was 18%. 18% interest. Now, I tried to buy a house in December of 1980. They laughed at me at the bank. They said, if you could get one, which you can't, it would be 22.5%. Now, what that means is everybody says, well, Ronald Reagan was president then. Well, okay, in December of 1980, he'd been elected, but he hadn't taken office yet. And in March of 1981, he'd been in office approximately 2 months. I take it back. It would have been April or May, possibly June, in 1981. And he'd been president for about 5 months, and his first budget didn't take effect until October. That being said, things were really, really bad. And it wasn't just that. We had the Iran hostage crisis going on. We had foreign policy miscues every place. We had just military bungles. We had the military was in absolutely appalling condition. We did have an all-volunteer army, just like we have now, but things were so bad with recruits that they actually had to make graphic novels as training manuals because recruits couldn't read. This is the kind of thing that was going on between 1977 and 1981. This is the reason that Jimmy Carter got thrown out in a landslide. And the press still labors under the misconception that really Carter was ahead the whole time and Reagan was behind. It's the same thing we heard with Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump. Don't worry, Hillary's going to win. Trump can't possibly win. Blah, 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 blah. Now, Trump didn't win in a landslide, but he certainly surprised everybody by taking states that everybody said he wouldn't take. Ronald Reagan basically took every state except D.C., which isn't a state, and I believe Minnesota, which was Walter Mondale's home state. Jimmy Carter's home state went for Reagan. I mean, it was a terrible upset. Now, that's not the only thing that gets talked about at the Reagan Library. It goes through the whole, basically, Ronald Reagan's whole history, and it's actually very inspiring. His childhood, his the things he had to overcome. He had grinding poverty. His father was an alcoholic, and yet he still was able to go to college. He became a radio announcer, and from there, everybody said, "Well, you have a movie star kind of persona, so you should become an actor." And he did acting work. I had people I can remember debating the Clintons in the 90s, and things would come up about military service because, you know, Billy didn't serve, Bill Clinton. And in fact, he wrote that infamous letter to the officer in charge about showing up for his reserve duty, because what he did was he signed up for reserves to get college help, and then said he wouldn't be showing up for his reserve duty. And, you know, we loathe the military and that kind of thing. Somebody said, well, Ronald Reagan didn't serve. I'm like, 3 years in the Information Corps during the war, that's service. So you hear a lot of junk about Ronald Reagan. The Ronald Reagan Library will, the left is starting to crawl out of the woodwork now that he's been dead for, what is it, 2000? When did he die? 2009 or 2008 or somewhere in there. I don't know the dates. I don't remember.
I can't remember. I was thinking 7 or 8.
So. Yeah, somewhere in there. Unlike
many people, I don't necessarily,
mark time.
Create a national holiday out of February the 6th.
You know? Yeah, that's right. Now that he's been dead and can't defend himself, and there are a lot of people who are, who were his cabinet members and things that can't defend him anymore, they're starting to come out and say, oh, he left us in a horrible position. No, he didn't. He left us in a great position from where we'd been. We'd been deep in the hole, and he filled in a lot of the hole. Did he fix it all? No. There was a lot of people that he had in his cabinet that I would much rather have not been in there. But that's beside the point. And you can find all that history out up there. And while we were up there, they also had a very interesting, you don't necessarily see the connection, but they had a very interesting display on the Titanic. And how they tied it in was, of course, the wreck of the Titanic was discovered during his presidency. And how did that tie in? Well, what's interesting was that it started out, they're revealing that this is just start of really sort of starting to come out. Ballard, who was searching for the Titanic, was really on the Navy's dime searching for a nuclear submarine that had broken up and sunk. And they were looking for the nuclear reactors, and they were looking for the wreck, and they wanted to see if they could figure out what happened. You know, this was in the 60s. So Ballard was actually out there searching for the submarine, and he came up with a unique theory that actually led him both to the submarine, and once he found the submarine, which took him not very much time at all after using his theory, and they talk about the theory, basically that any kind of a wreck like that will leave a debris field of a great length. All you do is look for the debris field. And he once he found the beginnings of the debris field, he just followed it right to the main part of the wreck. Well, that's what he did with the Titanic. But once he was off the Navy's dime, or off the Navy's time, finding the submarines, the Thresher and I think the Scorpion, I think the Scorpion was the one they couldn't find. They said, okay, have at it, go find the Titanic. They knew that's what he wanted to do. And he had all this equipment and all this money. Everybody kept asking, where did he get the money from? Where did he get the money from? Well, Nat Geo said they gave him the money for it. Then Nat Geo came up with a fraction of what he spent on that project. Okay. The fact is that the Navy paid for it. And he talks about that because it's all declassified now. 34 years later, I forget when when the Titanic was discovered. Was it 86? So it was 31 years ago. The Navy's not too worried about it now. It's pretty common technology these days to look for wrecks. So they do a big presentation on this, and there's a big presentation on there's kind of a memorial to the crew and the lost people of the Titanic, and especially they pay attention to the crew because those are the people who get the least kind of the publicity, if you will. Oh, by the way, Ronald Reagan's Air Force One is there. It's inside of a pavilion, inside of a glass pavilion, and one of the Marine Ones is there. It says it's not his because they said Ronald Reagan's helicopter is still in service, so we can't display it here. but they had Lyndon Johnson's in there, and I don't know how Nancy Reagan rigged it up to get Lyndon Johnson's MH1 for the Reagan Library, but nonetheless, because that one was in service until Clinton. So I'm not sure how that one, but in any case, you get to walk through both. And I don't know about you, if you've been to the Air Force Museum and seen all the Air Force Ones, the one that's missing is the one that's in the Reagan Library. And it does have a plaque that says on loan from the United States Air Force Museum. And so we were laughing about that, and the guy says, yeah, I think it's a permanent loan.
Yeah, well, you know, it's interesting you say that because it got me thinking about something else here a little closer to home. There was some news articles that hit here just a few weeks ago while we were on our little hiatus that someone had decided to take a permanent loan of the gold statue of the lunar lander that sat at the Neil Armstrong Air and Space Museum near Wapakoneta. Now, Chuck, this was a solid gold miniature of the lunar lander. It has disappeared.
Oh, boy.
Now, this happened just a few weeks ago. We didn't talk about it previously, but, you know, when you said permanent loan, that's got me to thinking about that. Somebody took a permanent loan. Now, I'll guarantee you, folks, nobody's holding on to that thing as the lunar lander and then going to try to sell it on eBay or take it to a jeweler or something in order to try to get it your pawn shop. That has probably already been melted down, and the gold itself is being then, you know, refashioned to something else.
It's put in ingots.
Sold or traded off.
Yeah, it's put in ingots, and somebody said, hey, you want to buy some gold ingots
Want to buy a half ounce of gold?
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. So anyhow, I mean, just if you thought you know, these things on permanent loan, at least if the loan's going one direction, people actually still get to see the objects, still get to be close to them, still get to understand the history. Not so much for the Armstrong Air and Space Museum, sadly enough. But I just thought that was interesting. And you know, You've had some adventures. I'll give you that. You mean you know how to pack a lot into a week? Because yeah. You were gone about a week. So
and I was working. And I was working a trade show 3 days.
And
you're
working a trade show for your industry at the same time.
Yeah.
Oh, I mean, Chuck, you're an Iron Man. I love it. you know, but you know, there's more. You know, as we're talking about this, and it kind of gets us around. You know, all the things that you're working with. You know, all of the thinking about Reagan and thinking about the economy and thinking about everything. And we know right now that here in 2017, we have, I'm not sure how best to accurately describe this. Chaos. Yeah, okay, I think that's what we'll call it, is chaos.
Yeah, that covers it.
You know, you have a dysfunctional Congress who can't get their major bills passed, although I'm among the small handful who actually don't believe that they're actually trying to get these bills passed, like repealing Obamacare.
Oh, no, they didn't want to do that.
And dealing with illegal immigration and fixing the debt crisis. So what do we have now? We have a couple of leaders in Paul Ryan and Mitch McConnell who really look like they are lost, that they're floundering. Paul Ryan is now sitting here with more egg on his face because Donald Trump, being a guy who really isn't beholden or committed to the Republican Party as a ideological entity, has decided that if he can't get work done through the majority leadership, he's going to go work with the minority. And so Chuck Schumer and Nancy Pelosi have now got the president's ear, or he is, you know, bending theirs, one of the two, in order to get a few things done. And one of those things, it looks like that Trump wants to get done, and now it's starting to make a whole lot of sense about some of the stuff he did over the weekend, or over the Labor Day weekend. He wants to get done a raising or eliminating the debt ceiling. You know, and that's a little piece where basically they set a level at which the level of the federal debt cannot rise without congressional approval. He's tired of that and he wants to get rid of it. Now, Chuck, you and I both know that's not a great economic idea.
It's terrible.
If you give government, who has the power of force to take what they want, if you take off one of the chocks, one of the restraints, one of the straitjackets, by the debt ceiling vote and calling people to be accountable if they decide to raise the debt ceiling, if you take that away and basically say, well, you don't have a ceiling anymore, so whatever you need to spend, spend it. I don't believe that that's going to be at all healthy for the body politic in America.
No, I don't think so. But Trump's, you know, but Trump's also
playing an interesting game here.
Yeah,
he's reaching out to Pelosi and Schumer in order to have them support the debt ceiling elimination in exchange, I think, for him backing off or radically acceding to Congress's, or at least the members of Congress, but that's not necessarily Paul Ryan, it's among these members of Congress, who want to basically hand out amnesty for illegal immigrants to this country. We'll start with the DACA, or the, this was a Obama-era program called Delayed Action for Childhood Arrivals. So in other words, if someone came across the border illegally and they brought kids with them, well, we may send the parents packing, but we won't send the kids packing. Problem with that, though, is, Chuck, is some of these kids are now in their 20s because they came over, I mean, they may have come over at the age of 17. They may have come over at the age of 15 or something of that nature. But, you know, after 6 or 7 years, they've matured. They're now adults. Question remains, why, if there has been this deferred action, i.e. giving them basically a window of opportunity, why are we still talking about so many hundreds of thousands of children who you would think most of them could have applied for and by this time gained United States citizenship? There's a little problem there. But the Pelosi's, the Schumer's, and the Paul Ryan's of the world basically are, you know, want to play the emotional card, and of course the media is helping them by saying how horrible it is that, you know, Trump's going to beat up on these kids. Well, Trump's even signaling right now, you know, he's basically said, all right, we're gonna end that program, but we're gonna delay it 6 months while Congress gets their act together and works. And because, well, you know, according to Sarah Huckabee Sanders, his press secretary, it's because Trump is following the Constitution and it's Congress's role to deal with this issue and not executives. I'll give him a little credit for that, but I still think a bigger part of the pull of Trump using it as leverage pressure in order to get a couple of things that he wants to get done desperately, one of which is building a border wall, and the second one is eliminating the debt ceiling. So he can restructure the economy how he sees fit. I'm sitting here just looking at this and I'm thinking, okay, it's going to be a strange looking fall because you're going to have people like Mitch McConnell and Paul Ryan out there. They're losing support rapidly of even people in their own caucuses because the president's making an end run around them and being with their ideological opponents in order to get the things done that many of the majority Republicans campaigned that they would want to do.
Yes. Now, the whole debt ceiling thing, I kind of see where it's coming from on this, although I disagree with him on it. What he's saying is, to a large extent, is that the debt ceiling is essentially meaningless except for use as a political football. Because
That's true.
They raise it at will. It means nothing. Essentially, everyone says, "Okay, we need. We're spending way more than the debt ceiling allows. Therefore, we got to raise it." So we go through this whole rigmarole, where everybody says, "Oh gosh, we'd better raise the debt ceiling," and they all go out to lunch and come back and pass the raising of the debt ceiling, or it turns into a political football, and they all fight about it, and in the end, they all pass it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, and of course, what they do is they shake their sword and say, "If we don't get the debt ceiling increased, we may have to shut government down."
Yeah,
you know, I've never been an individual who's been like, "Oh, well, it's horrible if we have to shut government down." I've been like, "Go ahead and shut it down for a while. Maybe that'll give some breathing room."
Well, in the end, it doesn't really do anything. Yeah, shutting the government down, basically, it furloughs a few employees who, oh, they get sent home without pay, and then later they get back pay. It's meaningless. It's completely meaningless to shut the government down, because what part of it do you actually shut down? Well, you shut down about maybe 10 or 15%. You shut down things like hot dog vendors at national parks, and they may pull the bars across at a national park, and they may... you know, there's a number of May dues. I can remember in the 90s when the government did shut down for a few days around Christmas time. Oh, so the Santa won't be at such and such a national park. And all these people who were hoping to have all these things at the national park won't have. It was nonsense. It was junk. It was stuff that everybody said, we can probably get by without having that come out of our wallet. Well, the answer is, you didn't really get by without having it come out of your wallet, because all those people got their pay afterwards. So basically,
right? Yeah, they basically got back pay.
Yeah, exactly. It's laughable.
One of the things, though, Chuck, if you think about it, that might be good from a government shutdown, and you mentioned the parks, is it may be a way to keep people from tearing down historical statues in these national parks, because we'll just close and lock the gates and say you can't come in right now.
Well, it may be more of the case where they lock them down and people go in while they're locked down and get the job done, and then you come back to all these destroyed monuments. The deal with most of these monuments is, and the feds have made it pretty clear, that you're not tearing any down on federal property. They're all in city parks and state places and that kind of thing. So, you know, here's what I say about that. You know, we never really talked about Charlottesville. If Charlottesville wants to take down their Confederate monuments, if they're that dumb, if they want to deny their history, then do so. Why don't you go up the hill and burn down Monticello? Because, well, let's face it, Thomas Jefferson held slaves. And there's ample evidence for that. If you've ever visited Monticello, there are slave quarters in the basement. When you go down into the section where the kitchens were and that kind of thing, you might want to go burn those down because, after all, there's evidence that he was a slaveholder. You know, it's undeniable. This is silly. We can use it as, instead of using it as a learning experience, and instead of getting at the truth of why these men, different men who they're tearing monuments down, fought for the Confederacy, and it surely was not. Had nothing to do with preserving slavery, in most cases. Were there some people who were fire eaters at about protecting slavery? Oh, absolutely. The firebrands in the South, yeah, they were all about slavery. Was Stonewall Jackson all about slavery? No, he wasn't. He held slaves, but he understood that slaves were human beings that were to be treated as human beings, and he was very torn as a man of faith about you know, owning slaves, and essentially he was well aware, as was Robert E. Lee, after serving as a manager on his wife's farm. I mean, his wife owned Arlington Farm, which is now Arlington National Cemetery, and we can talk about that, how that came to be. It was not a good thing that it's a good thing now, but it was a terrible thing at the time, and how the federal government acquired that piece of property. But Robert E. Lee had been a manager, and he discovered that he would much rather work with free labor than with people who were in a condition that they understood they were in, but they wanted to be out of desperately. And I believe you'll find that if you want me to say that Robert E. Lee and Stonewall Jackson and all these people in the South were egalitarians who thought that their black slaves were equal in ability and intellectual capacity with them, no, they did not. And guess what? Neither did Abraham Lincoln or virtually any of the abolitionists. The ones who knew it was correct were people like Frederick Douglass, who, despite his flaws, is a very admirable person. I mean, a true genius. Frederick Douglass was a genius. There's no doubt about that. And there were other black men who clearly were gifted. After the war, who am I thinking of? Booker T. Washington and George Washington Carver and that kind of thing. All these people brought up on in the situation of slavery and just post-slavery, and it was not pleasant in the South. One of the reasons it wasn't pleasant, the United States had terrible trouble coming out of the whole slave thing, because we're the only place that basically had fought a war to get it done. And what did we do in the South? Instead of doing real reconciliation in the South, what we did was we imposed Reconstruction as a form of vengeance. Well,
yeah, that's true.
You know that there's a phrase that let's just say garbage rolls downhill. Who was at the bottom of the hill?
Mm-hmm.
It's the former slaves, and so what did they get? They got the blame for Reconstruction, when it wasn't, because you couldn't blame the North, or you couldn't take it out on the North, because they had the guns. So who'd you take it out on? You took it out on your former slaves. You blamed them for it. A stupid reaction? Yeah, real stupid. I'll ask the question, where did the South get the idea for Jim Crow laws? The South got the idea for Jim Crow laws from the North. Places like Illinois and Ohio, okay, who had passed laws that essentially required free blacks to put up multiple thousands of dollars in bonds to be allowed to move to the state and live there. So the racism was just as rampant in the North. And am I impressed with, we ended slavery, blah, blah, blah. Well, the war wasn't about slavery. It was about economics, and it was about a constitutional interpretation. And you can't talk about economics in the South without talking about slavery. That's where the slavery connection is. So that's where all these generals who fought, many of them were abolitionists in nature. They knew that slavery was going to have to end. They knew it was coming to an end, and that it wouldn't last probably yet another 20 years, because people were beginning to figure out that it was cheaper to pay a man a day's wages than it was to take him and build him a home and take care of him from cradle to grave. And so what kind of a system are we preparing to try to go to in this country? We're trying to go to a cradle-to-grave system. What is that? What would that make us if we become wards of the state? Essentially, it makes us slaves, despite any...
Well, of course.
Despite any reference to skin color. It's not about skin color. White people came here as indentured servants. It's a form of slavery. In fact, it's a biblical form of slavery. You could indenture yourself for the purpose of having your passage paid here, or getting enough money to start your own. For instance, if you indentured yourself to a printer, you would learn the printing trade, and you could go out and start your own print shop at the end, and you would have enough money to do it. Why? Because you took an indentured position. Again, you became the slave, but the holder of the indenture had to feed you, had to house you, had to clothe you. Was it always a great system? No, because we're human beings. Some people would keep their indentures in rags and feed them next to, put the soup made from potato peelings and, that kind of stuff. But most did not do that. I'm not going to say the same for slavery. However, you have to remember that a slave was a valuable thing. I mean, costing thousands of dollars to buy a slave. And so, in those days, $2,000 was a lot of money. A lot of money. When people made hundreds of dollars a year, the average person made a couple hundred bucks a year, $2,000 was a lot of money. So you tended to take care of your property.
Some of us today.
Well, that's right. You don't want to lay out $2,000 all at once.
Yeah, that's right.
I kind of went on a rant there, but the whole we need to become more cognizant of our history. People are so ignorant of history, and I'll be quite honest. I'll be quite honest. The Antifas are among the worst. Mm-hmm. They're among the worst, and who has miseducated them? Well, they're teachers in school who were miseducated by their teachers in college, and now they're going off to college to be further miseducated. It's amazing to me the grotesque misinformation that's out there in college classes. I'm a 1989 graduate, and I took some history classes and I took some economics classes. And it's embarrassing, some of the stuff that we were quote unquote taught. That was just flat false. I mean, you go read the original source documents. How you drew that conclusion out of what you read, I don't know. But there are movements that take hold, and right now the movement is that everybody, anyone who has a slight amount of color in their skin is being oppressed. Well, it's just flat out not true. Is there still racism out there? Of course there is. That's a dumb. It would be dumb not to say there was. It's still out there.
There wasn't. Yeah, there's still a lot there, Chuck.
Yeah, I know,
but
there is.
You talked about Antifa and learning from history. I think we have another participant who's looking to take the title. And this is coming over from friends at Breitbart.com. No, we still read Breitbart, even though Steve Bannon, blah, blah, blah. But Breitbart.com, in their tech section, they have an interesting headline, and it says, Cato Project, quote, Islam consistent with libertarian principles, tolerance, and individualism. Now, okay, you want to talk about this? I think that the Cato Institute, which is a libertarian think tank, and they run this website called libertarianism.org, on that website, on libertarianism.org, they put up a post, they tweet that phrase, Islamic teachings are consistent with many libertarian principles such as tolerance, property rights, and individualism. Wow, Chuck. I can't understand how somebody at Cato or on this website decided to want to jump in both feet and jump to the deep end of the dumb pool. And supposedly also the post linked to the tweet that they put out, they praised someone as a libertarian hero, a Muslim by the name of Ibn Khaldun. Now, Ibn Khaldun was a historic figure in Islam, and basically has claimed, and this is a quote, somebody pulled, now this is the great thing about the web and the internet and social media, that when somebody really goes out there and puts their foot in it, there are other people who help push to the end of the pool by filling in what they're not saying. And what other folks chime in with was they pulled a section of the writings of Ibn Khaldun where he said, quote, "Therefore, the Negro nations are, as a rule, submissive to slavery because Negroes have little that is essentially human and possess attributes that are quite similar to those of dumb animals, as we have stated." Unquote by Ibn Khaldun, Islamic scholar. Chuck. Wow. You know, you and I have had run-ins with folks in the Libertarian Party and from Cato, and usually it's around the issue of life and abortion, because a consistent libertarian believes abortion should be legal, because they don't see the unborn child as having individual rights. The depth of foolishness, the depth of, dearth of understanding of your phrasing really caught up with them this time.
Yeah. Yeah. Wow. Yeah. How do you even go there? Now, one thing about some libertarians, I will come to the defense of some libertarians. I would think specifically about Thomas Woods, who was a traditional mass Catholic, Latin mass Catholic. Would argue in favor of the rights of the individual being going down to an unborn fetus. So you're talking more about left libertarians, the Rachel Madcows or Rachel Maddow, those kind of people. Who would argue in favor of they're hyper individualists? They do not believe in the individuality of the fetus simply because it's attached. When I say fetus, I mean unborn baby, because I don't like that particular language. Once you get into the core of it, I'm amazed. But Cato has always been big government libertarians, which is in my mind is a an oxymoron. And here we go with a demonstration of Cato's oxymoron sort of mentality. I'm really not all that shocked, because Cato has always been a kind of a weirdo, when Cato is on, they're on, but when they're off, they're way off.
And this time they're like
way off,
somewhere out in crazy field. But I just thought that was interesting because it isn't just Antifa and academic liberals. And again, this is coming from a project of the Cato Institute. Now, Cato has some good stuff out there, especially on economics, but I still don't get where they understand where they want to. Equate is, now I think it's interesting too, Doug, because if you parse this carefully, they say Islamic teachings are consistent. They didn't say Islam is consistent, the adherents of Islam are consistent with these principles, because I guess tolerance is great as long as you're Muslim. Anyone else that we're seeing how they handle non-Muslims when you take a look at what's going on with all of the various things with ISIS, Al-Qaeda, etc. You know, we've seen beheadings, we've seen people being burned alive, people being, you know, drowned, all in the name because they will not submit or bow their knee to Islam. So tolerance? Yeah, don't think so. Property rights? Well, you know, we made the argument that while we have our liberals and the Antifas and the progressives tearing down historical monuments because they feel that, you know, they want to rewrite history, well, when Islamic radicals are starting to take over in some of these areas, we saw it in Iraq, Iran, what do? They destroyed those historic monuments. They ran people out of their homes, burned their homes. What about property rights? I don't see that being a adherence to individual property rights. And individualism? Well, just see if a Muslim woman walks down the street without her burqa on, what happens to her. And we've seen, you know, or if an Islamic woman decides to not follow the directions of her father in choosing someone to marry. We've seen it here in America.
Yes.
Honor killings. Okay. Gee, what happened to individualism? Boy, I think Cato needs to back out and rethink their entire structure on that one, because it's completely out of line. So anyhow, so other things that are completely out of line, Chuck, and I know we're going to be running short on time here, but I want to get to these couple of items. Before, you know, we've talked a little bit about DACA. We've talked about, you know, Trump going to the Democrats. The other thing that's happening in D.C. right now is I think that there's a realigning of the center. And I say that because there's two big things that have just been announced in the last, 24 hours. The first thing is that a Congressman, Charlie Dent, who is a Republican centrist from Pennsylvania, liberal, has just announced he is not going to see election in 2018. He's now, that's important because Charlie happens to be the co-chairman of a caucus called the Tuesday Group, the moderate wing of the GOP, or what they call themselves the governing wing of the Republican Party. Unquote. Looks to me like Dent has decided that the Tuesday Group isn't strong enough to help him stay in Congress, because he's been getting an awful lot of flack back home. As a matter of fact, there was a huge blow up at a town hall meeting against some of his positions, where like voted against defunding Planned Parenthood. He basically has opposed the Trump's ban on the high-risk countries, the temporary ban. He's opposed that. He's been fighting against conservative ideas in Congress. And, you know, basically his idea that he's worked to instill, quote, stability, certainty, and predictability in Washington. Okay, let's what he's saying is, I've fought to keep the machine running just the way it's been running.
Yeah.
Because we benefit from this. Politically, financially. That's the reason he's been there and why he's been fighting. But now that he's starting to realize that he's a primary challenger and the worm's turning, and obviously their internal polling is showing that he's in trouble, he's out. Now that's interesting, because what does that say about Tuesday? Well, it's another thing, and it's just been announced. And your former congressman, I don't believe congressman now. I think maybe you're over in Bob Gibbs' district.
Nope, I'm in Pat T. Berry's district. Nope.
Are you still in Pat T. Berry?
I am, yeah.
Okay, well, your congressman just announced that he is going to be the chair of a new caucus, or a retooled caucus,
yes,
in the House called the Main Street Caucus. Now, does that sound familiar? Yeah, because former Congressman Steve LaTourette, late former Congressman Steve LaTourette, formed a group outside the caucus called the Main Street Partnership. Now, Main Street Partnership were the moderate socially liberal / progressive in the Republican Party. And they go and run people in these seats and in open seats in order to get more centrist leftists into Congress. Well, LaTourette died. The Main Street Partnerships kind of wavered. So we're going to have the main caucus, and of course, your congressman, Pat Tiberi, is going to be the chair of this centrist governing caucus.
Okay, to everybody who told me Pat, yeah, to everybody who told me Pat Tiberi was a real conservative, told you so. Told you so.
Well, it's starting to look like maybe you're more right than they want to admit. But I think it's very interesting because what it's also showing is that caucus, which is the conservative caucus in the House, you know, has really done an excellent job of being over on this Tuesday group. But that they are very concerned about their own futures, and so they're trying to caucus together in order to try to prevent, well, what I would hope is inevitable, which is the legislation and the initiatives and will be pushed far enough to conservative principles that they will look so far out of line they will have trouble holding their seats, just like Charlie Dent has found out. Just like Luther Strange is about to find out in Alabama, because Roy Moore is still polling significantly ahead of him in every poll that's been run out there, and has just now has received the endorsements of luminaries in the what I would say the conservative media world of Sarah Palin, Sean Hannity, and very interestingly enough, just yesterday was announced Congressman Jim Jordan had endorsed Roy Moore for the Alabama Senate runoff. Now that's pretty impressive when you've got the co-founder of the House Freedom Caucus endorsing a Senate candidate.
Yeah, exactly.
There's something to this because there's, and of course, if you're Jim, you want more conservatives in the Senate because then when you send good legislation over to them, it won't die without ever being heard.
Exactly. It'll have some proponents.
You can push the agenda to where you get a more Senate leader. Because they're all looking at the poll numbers. Mitch McConnell, among his folks in Kentucky, are horrible. Nationally, they're horrible. People can't see Mitch McConnell, and if he can't hold a seat with an appointed incumbent, that they're spending over $3 million in ad revenue attacking Roy Moore now for this Senate runoff, which is coming up in a couple of weeks. If Mitch McConnell can't win this, it may be a referendum on his ability to lead. And if that's the case, there are probably numerous people, including his own deputy, John Cornyn, who would be more than happy to throw him under the bus in the Senate majority.
Yeah, now, first of all, I want to say apologies, folks, for the quality of the signal. I don't know what's going on here. We have your audio buries terrible at the moment.
I apologize. You know, I'm sitting here with 5 bars. I don't know what's going on.
You never know, Barry. You just never know. And I'm wired into a cable system. So who knows? It's Skype. It's something up with Skype. And normally we don't have this trouble. Okay. What we're looking at here is essentially the breakdown of the old system. You are beginning to see a system developing in politics that politicians have been hoping to avoid, and that is actually people. I thought Donald Trump was brilliant with the whole when he brought DACA to an end, and Paul Ryan and everybody was beating their chests and saying how terrible it was and how awful and blah, blah, blah. And Trump's reply was, "You want it, you pass it. None of this presidential action stuff. You want it, take ownership." Now, what does that say? That says Donald Trump, A, understands the Constitution way better than the likes of Ryan McConnell, the Tuesday group, the Main Street Caucus, blah, blah, blah. They understand it way better, and they understand, okay, if you want the thing, quit sitting around waiting for the president to sign a decree. No more phone and pen. If you want it, you pass it. You take ownership. You take the heat. And basically, I think what he was saying was, you pass it, I'll sign it. But guess whose head it's on? I'm not pushing for it. You want it, you pass it, I'll sign it.
Right.
Exactly.
Now,
exactly.
That's why...
And you know what? We talk about that being the more constitutional way to go.
Well, that's the only constitutional
because
way
Congress
to go, yeah.
Congress has... It's the only way to go. And it's funny, Jeff, because I want to make a quick plug here, but I know we're starting to time. I want to make a quick plug. For those listening on Saturday, Sunday, again, I'm going to be speaking to the Sons of the American Revolution Constitution Day event in Cincinnati. They've invited me to come down and speak on the Constitution and the importance of it. And I think that, you know, much of what we've talked about today and other programs is going to be wound into that that talk about why it's important for us to follow that document and why it may look funny when a politician or a statesman like Trump pushes in a constitutional manner. And you see the reaction of the political class who really are like, what, we can't do that. That's not right. No, it is absolutely correct from a operational standpoint of this government to fall back under the proper roles of the federal government and make sure that we don't have the courts legislating from the bench and the executive getting us into police actions without declaring wars and Congress acceding all of their rights and authorities over to the other branches and then wringing their hands about how we need to get a better president or we need to get more people in the Supreme Court in order for them to actually do their constitutional jobs. Also, I'm going to be talking about why it's completely ludicrous and foolish to be stepping for an Article 5 convention, which, folks, on Tuesday on the 12th, if you're hearing this on Saturday, on the 12th of September at the State House at 3:30 in the afternoon in the Senate hearing rooms, there's going to be a hearing on their resolution to get us into a CONCON. They didn't understand and hear the cry of the opposition during spring when we thought we had this resolution killed. So Bill Coley, the chairman of the Senate Government Oversight and Reform Committee, is bringing this thing back up again for another. Thankfully, they're not trying to vote it. I think they're just trying to see if we've gone away or we're still going to be there in force to say this is a foolish idea and you should back away from it. So if you love liberty, you love your country, and you understand as well as we do how dangerous one of these convention calls is, come on out and test the fire, show up in the committee room, to show your support for them setting aside or tabling Senate Joint Resolution Number 1. That's afternoon at 3:30, the Senate, here, Senate, I believe, hearing room, and it's the Government Oversight Committee.
Yeah, I'll repeat that because you cut out. The government, which committee? Barry.
Government Oversight and Reform Committee.
Oversight and Reform Committee. Yeah, sorry about that. We just have a terrible signal. Well, guess what, folks? I'm going to do my best to testify at that hearing. Business has kept me away from doing that, but I'm going to dig up some of my old testimony and put together new testimony because, honestly, my arguments remain the same. It's really not that tough. A constitutional convention during a time of national crisis is the worst idea you can imagine. We are extremely divided in this country right now, and of all the times to rebuild a new constitution, and I understand that the CONCON people say, no, it's only to amend the Constitution. Yeah, that's what they said at the first one. I will reiterate that until... My mouth goes dry and my ears bleed. The fact is, the first convention was designed to be an amendments-only convention, and the first thing they did was vote to operate in secret, and the second thing they did at the convention was vote to chuck the old Articles of Confederation, thus violating their charter. But the reason they could do that was because they're a plenipotentiary body, meaning they have all constitutional authority to rewrite it. And that's what will happen. That being said, we are out of time. I would ask you to please be in prayer for some things going on in Columbus right now as we're recording. There is an active shooter. By the time you hear this, it will have everything will be known. It looks like no one was injured and the shooter was captured. I have reports of two active shooters in two schools, but it's too early, and I'm not getting anything about the second one. So please be in prayer for all the people involved. And we would ask that you would comment on anything you've heard on here that you found interesting. www.principledpolicy.com. That's principledpolicy.com. And join us again next week for another Principles and Policies.